Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined down the line by Julia Angwin, award-winning investigative journalist and editor-in-chief of The Markup, a non-profit newsroom that investigates the impact of technology on society. A winner and two-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Journalism, Julia led investigative teams at ProPublica and The Wall Street Journal. The author of the best-selling Dragnet Nation, examining the quest for privacy in a world of relentless surveillance, she co-founded The Markup in 2019. The project uses data-centered journalism to examine how powerful institutions are using technology to change our world. Julia, thank you for joining me.
It's great to be here.
Now, there couldn't be a better time to talk now that the tech giants have been forced to silence a president using their channels to incite violence. What's your take? How optimistic are you now that, you know, we don't have a madman in the White House?
It's a good question. I think like the removal of Trump from the social media that he loves so much, I think woke most people up to the real power that these companies have to make arbitrary decisions about speech around the globe. And I think maybe the average person might not have realized before how much power these companies have. And that is really the mission I have as a journalist, is to make sure that we hold these companies accountable, because they are these new powerful actors without much regulatory oversight. And I think we, the public, need to know more about how they make these decisions, what decisions they're making, and what those implications of those decisions are for the public.
I mean, that's obviously a huge undertaking, is it not, to hold the tech companies to account in that way? How do you go about monitoring them, and how do you actually go about, you know, the holding of them to account?
Yeah, it's a very much a David and Goliath situation. You know, we have a newsroom of about 25 people. Not all of those are in news. You know, we have some business side people as well. And we are tiny in comparison to these giant tech companies with tens of thousands of employees around the world and, you know, sort of unchecked power, really. But we do it through a unique approach. Half of our newsroom is programmers and half is sort of more traditional journalists, and they collaborate together on investigations. And the reason for that is that I think journalists need to use every tool at their disposal to uncover the truth, and technology is a great tool. And so we use a lot of automation and computer scripts and analysis to collect data at large scale and analyze it at large scale and get statisticians to help us understand the meaning in that data. And that kind of superpowers our investigative abilities.
I mean, you spent a year building a method of monitoring what content Facebook was pushing to users. I mean, is that an example of the hybrid sort of editorial and technical approach? How did you go about doing that? What were the challenges?
Yeah, that is a perfect example, right? So we built this thing called Citizen Browser, which is essentially a tool that we have paid almost 2,000 people across the United States to install on their computers. And it's essentially an app that they use to log into their Facebook accounts. And then we monitor their Facebook accounts. They don't use this app to access Facebook. They still go and use Facebook on their phone or their tablet or wherever they want to use it. But once a day, we basically run a query where we get what's at the top of their newsfeed, what kind of groups are being recommended to them, what ads are being served to them. And that allows us to get a snapshot of sort of what Facebook is doing on its platform. You know, they make a lot of promises, but it's very hard to hold them to account. But our panel allows us to see things like what the story we published this week was about how Facebook had said back in the fall before the presidential election that they were going to stop recommending political groups to users because they thought that those groups can be inflammatory and incite violence. And then after the Capitol Hill riots in January, they renewed that promise, said we still are not recommending political groups. But when we looked in the data from our panelists, we saw they were recommending political groups the whole time. And there would be no other way to know that without actually seeing into the Facebook feeds of all these people. Now, it is a tricky thing to do because Facebook is a really personal experience for people and they have a lot of personal information in there. So we have one of the biggest challenges of building this tool was the fact that we had to strip out all the personal information. So when we take their Facebook feeds, we actually have built automated tools that take out their name, their friends' names, photos, anything that could be personal. And we never see that. No human ever sees it. All the automated tools take that out. And then we receive only the data that's been scrubbed clean of that personally identifiable information. And that's a huge undertaking. It was, a team of 8 engineers over 10 months. And that's a really expensive project.
What do you then do with that analysis and that insight? I mean, how responsive are the tech giants to your entreaties? Like, can you say to them, hey, guys, can you be a bit less evil? Or is it about, sunlight being the best disinfectant, that it's bringing, their methods and some of the dangers of what they're doing to public attention and hoping to sort of shame them into doing things better? I mean, what's the actual change? Where do they feel the pressure? How does that manifest itself in terms of getting them to be better?
I think of us as sort of like auditors. We are out there basically policing and seeing if they're doing what they said they were going to do, right? Just the way an auditor would comb through your financial statements and see if you had actually done what you had said. That's what the IRS does with all of our tax returns. We are doing that to see what Facebook is doing and whether they are doing what they promised. But the problem is that there's no one else doing that, right? The regulators in Washington don't have this ability to see what Facebook is doing. They have to just trust their word. And I think that that is the role of journalism, is, just to be that watchdog that is on behalf of the public. And it would be wonderful if there were other people doing this and we didn't have to build this tool, but currently there isn't any sort of structure like that. In other industries that are more heavily regulated, like in airlines, for instance, you wouldn't just rely on the airplane makers to say that their airplane was safe. You have the Federal Aviation Administration and they check to see if things are safe. Now, they have catastrophic failures like the Boeing 737 MAX, but in general, their job is to check. And there is no one like that for the tech industry, right? And so we are trying to step into that role because it feels like an important role that needs to be filled.
Could you share with our listeners the journey of sort of setting up the markup in terms of, it's been quite a roller coaster ride for you in particular. Craig Newmark is a friend of mine. He's obviously a big benefactor of you guys. He's been on the podcast before. He's obviously incredibly committed to your success. But, how was the initial vision for what the markup is? Do you feel you're on track? There's the old adage, isn't it, that no battle plan ever survives contact with the enemy, as it were. Have you had to hone and refine the strategies you've gone along?
We have achieved more of the battle plan than I would have expected. I was working at ProPublica and I had assembled a small team of people who were doing this type of data journalism work. And it was, expensive and difficult to keep together. I had 2 programmers working and we were doing these data-driven investigations. And ultimately, it just didn't fit into the ProPublica newsroom because most newsrooms don't devote that much data resources to each investigation. They just can't afford to. So at any rate, I had been trying to cobble together these kind of investigative teams in newsrooms at ProPublica and then prior to that at the Wall Street Journal. And I just started to believe that there needed to be a newsroom that had this approach to journalism at its center, the idea of programmers working alongside journalists at the core and not as an add-on. In most newsrooms, because engineers and developers are really expensive, there are very few of them to serve a population of journalists that's much larger. And so they are a scarce resource and it's really hard for reporters to get time with those data people. And those data programmers are often really overwhelmed with requests. And so I wanted to build a newsroom that was different. And so I left ProPublica and it was a huge risk. It was the best job in journalism, still is, I think. And went out to see if I could raise money for this new idea. And amazingly, Craig Newmark believed in it and made a big bet on us. And I'm forever grateful for his support because putting something like this together is so ambitious. And it also is unproven, right? There aren't newsrooms like this. And there's a reason, because it's expensive and difficult work. But so far, we have actually produced a lot of really important investigations, like our investigation of Google that showed that they are advantaging themselves in search results, which was cited by Congress and has been referenced in all the antitrust cases that have been brought against Google. And so we feel like we're contributing to a new era of oversight of these companies where lawmakers need that data in order to make informed decisions about how to hold these companies to account.
And I don't want to dwell on, you know, the soap opera element of what happened in April 2019, but it felt a little bit that, you know, some of our listeners will be too young to remember Dallas, but Bobby Ewing was killed off and ousted from the show, and then a season later returned, Pam found him in the shower. I mean, if you could talk our listeners through, you know, that there were some tumultuous weeks, were they not, where there was a disagreement, you were asked to leave, and then you returned.
Yeah, so I left ProPublica with a colleague of mine who had been my partner on all my investigations, and he was sort of the data journalist that I worked alongside. And then we went out and found a woman who had come from Wikipedia to help us to run the business, because we didn't know how to run a business. And the three of us went out, founded the markup, recruited Craig Newmark and other funders to support us, and started hiring. And then as we got our way into it, the two of them banded together and fired me. And, you know, there are many different reasons that have been described about why that happened. But ultimately, it was a power struggle, right? I wanted to build a newsroom a certain way, and it seemed as though they wanted something different. So I was fired, and then the entire newsroom quit in protest. At that point, the funders stepped in and said, you know, we want to reevaluate the situation. I'm not sure we want to keep giving money to an entity that doesn't have any reporters, except for there were actually two that stayed. They couldn't afford to quit. And the funders thought about it. And over time, they decided to reinstate me and the rest of the staff. And we came back, and I found a new partner, Nabiha Sayed, who's a brilliant First Amendment attorney, and she runs the business side, and I run the news side. And it was a really difficult time. You know, it was one of those things where I have written about technology and the technology industry for my whole career, and I've seen this happen, right? It's pretty common in startups to have some drama like this, but for some reason I didn't think it would happen to me. But it did. And it was a real lesson, because I think the real lesson I learned from it was that, honestly, was about grit. You know, I just wanted it more. It was my baby, my dream, and I wanted to make it happen. And so I could have just like been fired and gotten another job, no problem. But I really wanted this newsroom to work. So I fought through it, convinced the funders to come back. And I couldn't be more grateful every day to have it up and running, because, you know, once you have your dream and then it's snatched away from you, you know, honestly, having had that experience has made running the markup now a lot sweeter, because I had this dream, I had it snatched away from me, and then I got it back. And so I feel a lot more grateful and happy, honestly, that I've been able to get it back on its feet. And so it really has made, even though I wouldn't recommend going through that, and I wouldn't want anyone to have to go through that, it really did make me more grateful and more just more willing to understand that, like, media is an uncertain business, and the time that we have with funding and support is a special time, and it may not always last. There are a lot of institutions out there struggling. And so I just want to make sure I enjoy the ride while we have it.
It's one of these things, isn't it, that's incredibly stressful at the time. But as you've already started to say, you know, over the years, you can reflect and say that it was actually a necessary part of the journey to kind of consolidate the mission, consolidate the team, and refine that sense of purpose and redouble your determination to deliver what you originally set out to create.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I've talked to a lot of people who since then about their journeys in different startups, and almost everyone has a story sort of like that. Mine was unusual in playing out in public so much. You know, every bit of it was covered in the New York Times, so that was pretty high profile. But a lot of startups have this in a more quiet way behind the scenes, and it does feel like it's part of the growth, right? It's like the institution has to figure out what it is. You know what I mean? And that plays out in sort of this human drama.
Tell us, how did you get started on this journey? Did you always want to be a journalist? Was this something that you were determined to do since childhood? How did you actually take the first steps along the way? Could you give our listeners a brief précis of your career?
Sure. You know, actually, I did not expect to be a journalist. I actually thought I would work in Silicon Valley as a technologist. I grew up in Palo Alto, and my parents were both programmers, early days of technology. So we were still in the early Apple, you know, personal computers had just come out. My parents were both super excited about them. We had like the first Apple II at home. And I thought that industry was everything. You know, I wanted to go be working at Apple or Hewlett Packard or one of these big companies. I studied math in college and I worked in my summers at Hewlett Packard. And I planned to go there after college. But while I was in college, I also worked on the college newspaper, mostly actually just for fun. You know, I didn't think of it as anything more than just like a hobby, but I got more serious about it over time. And by the time I was senior, my senior year, I was editor in chief of the college paper. And I thought, you know, I'm so young, maybe I'll just do a little bit more of journalism and then I'll go back to technology. So I decided not to go back to Hewlett Packard and see if I could just try out journalism for a few more years. And then I, of course, never went back. However, it did turn out to be really helpful to have been in the tech industry. As the internet became mainstream, I was suddenly the only person in many newsrooms where I was that had any tech experience, that knew how to program, that understood the lingo of the industry. And so I became, you know, a little bit of an expert and was able to make a career covering technology.
Is it the beat that you'll always have? Are you fascinated with it? Or might you 5 to 10 years from now choose a completely different beat? Are you a tech and data person, campaigning journalist, holding the powerful to account? Is that you set for life, or might you become, become a transport correspondent, or go off to write novels, or do something entirely different? So is this something that you feel is your niche?
You know, it's an interesting question. I'm generally in favor of expertise in journalism, and that's actually somewhat of an unsettled point, right? There are some journalists who believe that bringing a fresh eye to a beat is a good thing. And so you don't want people who are experts in their business. They get sort of jaded. They feel like they've seen all the stories before. And so in an argument like that, you know, somebody like me should rotate to another topic because I'm probably too deep in to technology. But I actually think expertise really helps you cover the beat. It allows you not to be snowed by basically propaganda. You know, that the companies, you know, a classic thing that technology companies will say to a journalist is, it's too complicated. You can't understand it. You know, trust us. And I think having expertise allows you to say, no, I do understand it. And I'm sticking to my position, which is that it's, you know, not correct. So I believe in expertise. That said, I would love to write novels. I would love to write books. They don't pay well. It's not a great profession, but I could easily imagine doing something like that later.
I mean, you've got a best-selling book already. And in fact, that brings me very neatly on to asking about that. I mean, tell us about Dragnet Nation in terms of what was the genesis behind it? What was the process writing it? What was the impact? I mean, I remember at the time when it was published, you warned that journalists were the first to feel the kind of impact of living what you called total surveillance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's funny thinking back on Dragnet Nation. I wrote it in 2013. I had been leading a privacy team at the Wall Street Journal. We had been doing investigations for a series called What They Know for 3 years, 2010 to 2013. And I then went and took a leave to write this book. And while I was writing it, the Snowden files came out. And so I was just super lucky that my book was kind of the first, I was already halfway through. So in some sense, I was just sort of the first privacy book to come out after Snowden because I happened to be already writing it. And the thing is that I felt sometimes like, well, maybe I'm just being overwrought. Like, you know, maybe it's not as bad as you think. Is this book just totally paranoid? And when I look back on it, it was under paranoid. Like I still didn't quite realize how bad it would get, how quickly in the world of surveillance, and how, you know, at that time I thought, oh, it's going to be a long time before facial recognition becomes like a big threat. Well, no, it's already being used in schools, law enforcement. It's totally unregulated. It's, there are people putting it inside of drones in order to do automatic strikes from the air. These were things that at the time I was thinking were just too sci-fi and were not likely to happen. And in fact, they did happen way faster.
Is the problem that technology and the development of it obviously you know, iterates and evolves at breakneck speed, and the implications for society, you know, it's always too slow to catch up, isn't it? Because by the time we've even thought about the privacy and the societal implications of a specific technology, the technology is always light years ahead of it and is already causing the very problems that, you know, we thought were years away.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I think that's not unusual. That happens with our progression of laws on everything, right? I mean, we had child labor for a long time before we passed laws against it. And it took a while. It took a while for people to realize that was wrong. It was took a while for muckrakers to write, you know, scathing inside the factory's reports that brought attention to that issue. And it took a while for the legal regime to adapt to it. And then we passed laws saying that was wrong. And it's inconceivable now, right? It's really inconceivable that we were sending, you know, 8-year-old kids into factories, but we were for like 16-hour days. And I think that's how these things happen. And I think the role of journalists is to correctly diagnose the problem so it can be solved. So I think that our job is to look at what's happening with technology, which, by the way, is a force for good in many ways, right? We wouldn't have survived this pandemic without all of us being on Zoom all the time and having email. And so there are lots of good things about it. It's just that we need to be clear about what the bad things are so that we can fix them, right? It's not like we stopped having factories. We just stopped having child labor in factories. Now, same thing with technology. Like we should be able to use it, but perhaps we shouldn't have it being used to sow hate and incite violence, right? So these are the kinds of questions that we need to address. And those are the kinds of questions I think that we at The Markup are trying to answer.
Do you think there's something about the human condition as to why we've been so slow to sort of catch up on the use of data and metadata? I mean, you know, big tech has been allowed to, you know, be way ahead of us in this, until recently, largely unregulated sphere. I mean, I can remember when Facebook came out and people were talking about privacy. And to me, it just seemed like some kind of esoteric issue. And it took me several years as a citizen to think, actually, no, there's big corporations here that are joining up the dots via metadata and cookies on my computer. And this is actually going to have an impact on my life. But there definitely was a few years when I think wider society was in denial about that.
Yeah, but I think that happens with all new technologies. I mean, do you remember the time when we all used canned soup for every recipe, right? Canned soup was a new technology and it was super exciting. And basically all of America transformed its cooking to work with canned soup. And then eventually we were like, maybe we should go to the farmer's market and get fresh vegetables, you know? And so I think we have a sense of euphoria about new technology and we adopt it really quickly. I mean, obviously smoking is the other perfect example of this. Everybody was like, this is amazing. I love this smoking thing, right? I stay thin, looks cool. And then we're like, oh, there's that cancer side effect, right? So I think, you know, in general, that's one thing that's nice about America is we're a really enthusiastic country. and so we're very excited about these things. And everybody was like, oh my God, I have a phone. I'm going to carry it with me everywhere. And now people are like, I feel like I'm a little addicted to this phone. I feel like it's impacting my relationships. Maybe I should try to dial back, you know, and I think we're in that reckoning phase right now where we're trying to reckon with what has this done to us and how do we moderate it?
I'd be interested to how you compare and contrast the big tobacco and big tech as villains, as it were. So like, I look back now and I think, well, big tobacco, they knew that cigarettes and nicotine and tobacco caused cancer and they were covering it up. You know, they were straight up nasty. Is big tech as nasty in a different way? Because, you know, I follow Jack Dorsey on Twitter and I follow Mark Zuckerberg. He strikes me as someone who's a bit of a tech bro, doesn't set out to do any harm, but is a bit arrogant and has some huge blind spots as to the harm that he is causing. Is that wrong? You know, Jack Dorsey seems to put out very thoughtful tweets about Twitter trying to encourage a more thoughtful and collegiate conversation. Or is he writing things like that and then pressing send and then sort of twirling his mustache in a dastardly fashion and he doesn't mean it? You know, is big tech, could, you know, can we hold them to account and bring them round to doing this more ethically? Or is it that they're just so relentlessly focused on growth at all costs, the bottom line money, that you know, they just frankly don't care about their impact on society?
You know, I think that that's a really good question. I think those tobacco executives also went home and tucked their children in and probably were nice people and went to church or, you know, they did civic things and they convinced themselves that what they were doing was fine. I don't believe that you have to be inherently evil in order to create bad things in the world, right? I think that the profit motive can push an institution in a direction that is not good while all the humans there are still trying to be well-meaning about it. And so I think the reason to have journalists and regulators is to be a force pushing the other way, so that the natural tendency to optimize only for profit and not for human thriving is pushed back against by society and by, you know, the independent watchdogs of journalists, the advocates, and then the lawmakers who we elect to represent us as people. And their job is to say, is this actually beneficial to society? Yeah, like, sure, it might be beneficial to Wall Street, but there are more stakeholders out there than just Wall Street. So I don't really think that the people involved, I'm not as interested in the question of whether they're evil or not. I think it's a sideshow, honestly, right? It doesn't really matter if Jack Dorsey thinks good things or bad things. What matters is his actions. And his actions are going to be dictated not just by his own feelings, but by, honestly, the forces that are being placed on him. And right now, most of those forces are really market forces to improve profits. And so that's what he's going to respond to.
I think sometimes it cuts to the heart of not necessarily intent, but also maybe the temperament of their character. I mean, several years ago, I can remember there's a furore that Facebook wouldn't allow pictures of women breastfeeding on there because they said that it contravened their sexualized content, which clearly it doesn't. To me, that was more of a kind of arrogant naivete on the part of Mark Zuckerberg, that he's a tech bro. He didn't know enough about it and he didn't look into it enough. He just kind of imposed what he thought his perception might have been. Do you think there's an element now that they're more open to holding themselves to account with Facebook's new, you know, council and so on and so forth?
I mean, I have to say there's not been a single change that I can think of at Facebook that wasn't brought about through public pressure, right? It took thousands of women talking about the breastfeeding ban to get them to change that position. It took years of advocacy by Jews to get the Holocaust denial groups off of there. It honestly took the riots in Capitol Hill to get, you know, Trump's incitement to violence off. And so I would say that the evidence suggests that they're mostly responsive to extreme amounts of public pressure and public shaming more than anything else. That it's not clear at all that there's sort of any evolution over there except a reactivity to the pressures that are placed on them. And so that's why I think it's important to keep those pressures up, because that's what they respond to.
I'm hugely in awe and give you maximum respect for, you know, winning a Pulitzer and being a runner-up two times for the Pulitzer Prize as well. I mean, that's incredible. I don't think I'll ever win a Pulitzer for this podcast. The best I could do is perhaps buy a fake one on eBay, maybe. I think you might be able to get one. You've got a real one. And, you know, I'm hugely inspired by that. Tell us about how you won that. I mean, it was part of the Wall Street Journal's team that recognized exposing corporate scandals in the US. I mean, that sounds to me like it was a fantastic adventure and a fantastic project to be involved in.
Yeah, it was in 2003. And if you remember in 2001, we had or 2000, I guess, we had the bursting of the tech.com bubble. And I was covering a company, AOL, which, you know, then became AOL Time Warner, at the Wall Street Journal. And we were thinking about, after the bursting of the bubble, there were a lot of accounting irregularities that came to light. And so the journal put together this team to look at what were all the different ways these companies had cooked the books during the bubble in order to get investors. And so the part that I contributed was around AOL. And it was really funny. So AOL at that time, Wall Street was giving them their stock points only based on ad sales and not based on profit. So they were losing money, which is, you know, to this day is still true with like Uber and the big tech companies. They often go public while losing money, but Wall Street gets all excited about their growth of their revenues. And so AOL was in that position where all the Wall Street wanted was revenue growth. So what AOL did was they came up with this hilarious way to boost their revenue. So they would, for instance, they had a company cafeteria. So they would pay their cafeteria vendor maybe twice as much as the contract should have been. And then the cafeteria vendor would spend half of that money back on ads. So they were able to look like they had more ad revenue than they did, but they were just taking it out of their own pocket, right? So they were basically buying ad revenue to cook the books. And so that was the part that I contributed. We called that a round trip deal because they sent the money back round trip back to themselves in order to boost their stock. You know, one thing that's kind of sad about that whole era, I would say, is that nobody went to prison or any of those AOL executives. They're all doing fine. They made millions and billions, and there were no consequences.
What do your duties involve now? Sort of, you know, what does a typical week look like? How do you divide your time between doing the actual journalism, commissioning other people's work? Is there an element of sort of people management? Are you doing a lot of ambassadorial stuff like this where you're representing, you know, all the various efforts and so on? You know, how does, if your week was a pie chart, what are the different sections of the pie chart and how, what are the various sizes? You know, what does a typical week actually look like?
Ooh, that's a tough question. My week, I try to keep a lot of time for working with the journalism and the journalists because we're still establishing this style of journalism and it is a unique one. When we do a big investigation and data analysis, we write like a statistical white paper analyzing our work and we get experts to review that paper. We spend a lot of time thinking about ways to build our technology to do investigations. And these are all tasks that are not normal newsroom tasks. So I spend a lot of time working on ways to make that process work better, ways to have our journalists and data journalists work better together, and how to make sure that we are building the tech infrastructure and the human infrastructure we need to make our journalists be able to achieve the most that they can. So I try to save a lot of time for that. But, you know, as your question indicated, obviously there's a lot of other things I need to do. And the top thing really is fundraising. I want to make sure that the markup stays viable. So I assist Nabiha Sayed, our president, in any fundraising tasks that she needs done. And also I spend a lot of time on just people management and getting this institution up and running. Like, you know, we had to write a style book and an ethics guideline and, you know, just sort of all the pieces that you need to have a newsroom that we had to write from scratch. We also have a really unique culture in that we don't use any techniques to track our readers. So we're a privacy-friendly website. So that means actually we spent a lot of time building special tools. Like, for instance, we weren't able to embed tweets on our page until we built a special tool for that. Same thing with videos. We weren't able to embed because, you know, the typical players out there all would track our readers. So we do spend a lot of time talking about our privacy promise to readers, how we can meet it and how that affects our ability to just display our work.
And what are the big sort of unticked boxes on your to-do list at the moment? I mean, quite apart from the day-to-day, do you have a sort of medium and long-term direction of where you want to take things? What's going to be the next big thing that you're going to do in terms of, you know, evolving and iterating? I mean, and also, you know, what are the challenges? What keeps you up at night?
Well, I think one of the big things that we're working on right now is this project that I was talking about before, Citizen Browser. It's a project to monitor Facebook. We hope we can add monitoring YouTube to it as well, and maybe some other platforms. And I think it's a really important approach towards journalism, which is what I call persistent monitoring. Journalism is generally, we're meant to be watchdogs, but our abilities to monitor persistently are pretty low. You know, persistent monitoring normally means like a journalist writes a story every day, like, okay, Trump did this, Trump did that. That's sort of how we do watchdog reporting. But the idea of building tools that can help us monitor at scale is something that I think that the markup is really unique in. We built a tool last year called Blacklight that allowed people to see how any website is tracking them. They just go to the website, type in a URL, and it tells you instantly a real-time analysis, like this website is trying to monitor your keystrokes, or this one is sending your data to Facebook, and all these things that you really couldn't learn anywhere else. And So I think we're building a practice around a new way to do journalism around persistent monitoring that I think is really important. And I want to make sure that we manage to keep doing that work and also convince people that they should support it because it is a different way of thinking about journalism.
Where do you feel you are, like in terms of your stage of the journey? I mean, if this was in your mind's eye, I mean, this, I'm just paraphrasing, but let's say it's a 10-year journey. Do you feel you're 10, 20, 30% of the way there? Is this something that you feel that is a lifelong mission now? And you know, I want to get a sense of how far you feel. If this was a progress indicator in terms of the overall project, what you're trying to achieve, how far along are you?
I mean, I feel like it's a little bit like, do you remember when Gmail was released and it was in beta for about 7 years?
Yeah. Yeah. I think perpetual beta.
Yeah. I think we're perpetual beta. Like, I think we've come out with our product. We're like early into our Gmail release and we are proving the model. And I think we're going to keep proving that model for quite some time. And I think because it's a new field and new practice, like it's not something that has an existing playbook. I think we're going to have to keep iterating and evolving it before we can really say it's a finished product. So I would say like we're 10% of the way in, but we've done I think we've done the hardest part, which is proving that pilot project that works, right? So we have these pilots, they do work. And now it's a question of, can we scale them? Can we maintain them? How do we consistently apply this approach to our work?
And you're the leader of an organization. To what extent is your job a bit like a baseball team manager where you're constantly looking, for other players, other journalists that you might be able to bring on board that have got a rare talent? Are you looking at good and bad practice in other organizations? Is there an element of where you know, what you're doing is cutting edge and obviously much needed, but is there an element where you have a BDI on, not necessarily the competition, but at least sort of benchmarking yourself against other organizations? Who might they be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm definitely always scouring for talent and looking at who's doing interesting work these days. I have a wish list of mile long, you know, and if somebody wants to give me all the money, I will definitely hire all those people. We've been trying to grow cautiously because, you know, we don't know what our fundraising environment is going to be like. It's been a weird, you know, year 2020, and 2021 may well be a weird year as well. Funders are a little bit concerned about what the future holds, how bad the economy is going to be. And so we're being cautious about expansion. So I think right now, most of my looking around is really kind of in the realm of dreaming. But yeah, I keep an eye on what others are doing in this space. And I think that it's interesting, though. I don't see anyone as a direct competitor because we don't chase the news. Like Google announces something or there's big news about this or that, we don't feel the need to cover it, right? The Times is going to cover it. Everyone's going to cover it. We really try to do things that only we can do. Like, we want to use our resources to do things that are really special. So we are much more likely to not focus so much on the day-to-day and think about what are the big stories that we can do that no one else can do. And that means that we publish less frequently than most places. We publish 2 or 3 times a week. And we often do really unique stories that no one else has.
What qualities do you look for when you're hiring, you know, in the people that are applying for jobs? I mean, assume that some of our listeners want to send their resume to you because they're very excited to join you on your journey. How should they polish their resume? What direction should they give the polishing?
You know, that's a great question. A lot of people think you have to have data skills to work in our newsroom, and you don't actually, like, except for, I mean, obviously the data journalists do, but for the traditional journalists, we don't expect you to know how to do any, you know, coding or anything like that. And in fact, it's honestly fine because you have all these programmers you can work with. What we do need is we need a commitment to understanding how to bridge the gap. So what we need more than technical skills is the ability to be understanding of the technological process. Engineering is a really different profession. The way that those projects progress is slow and steady and iterative, and there's a lot of failure. Things break, they have to get fixed. And so what we do need in journalists is some patience to work with that process, to understand that it's not just a magic box. You can't just go over to the data journalist and be like, get me this data stat. You know, I need it. It's not like that. You have to work with them. You have to help them figure out what is the thing that we need to collect. What kind of data do we need to answer the question that we want to answer? And often there's a lot of reporting about what kind of data we need. So we don't just go out and start collecting data. We actually do reporting and say, okay, I'm looking at, you know, this industry, and what is the question I want to ask here? What data is available? And so it's a different way of reporting with a data journalist. And so we are looking for reporters who can do that. But honestly, a good reporter is somebody who's, you know, good at getting humans to talk to them, right? That's part of the job. That's most of the job. And so most of the people who are great reporters are pretty good at forging these relationships. But I would say that's the thing that's pretty unique in our newsroom, is that it's not just the reporting skills. There is this collaboration with engineers that many people have not done before.
And for those that are going on your website for the first time, perhaps when they're listening to this podcast, the menu talks about Ask the Markup, Band, Bounty, Backlight, Citizen Browser, Google the Giant, Locked Out. Can you tell our listeners about that? Would you describe those as campaigns? Are they sections or attributes of your journalism? How would you explain that?
Yeah, those are our series. So we have different series of stories that we're pursuing. So Google the Giant, for instance, is a series we're doing on Google, and it's huge power, right? It's huge company, owns, is the most popular search engine, most popular video player, most popular email. Like they have real market dominance. And so we have been looking at ways that they use their power. So there's a whole bunch of stories in that series about how they preference themselves in search results, how they have the secret algorithm that sorts your Gmail and moves some things into this box called promotions. And that's really hurt some nonprofits who were trying to raise money. So we look at different aspects. We have a story in there about how they had a secret memo internally where employees can't use certain words that might trigger an antitrust investigation. So we've been sort of aggressively covering them, and that all those stories are in there. And then all the other series that you mentioned are different series. Blacklight is our series on privacy and our tool that lets you look up a website and see how it's tracking you. We have a series, Locked Out, about tenant screening algorithms that landlords are using to determine whether they're going to let you rent an apartment or not, based on sort of an automated software check. So we have a whole bunch of different series, and it's a good way to start on our website is to look at some of those series and see which of those topics really speak to you and that you might want to read more about.
One of the things that fascinates me about you guys is how you go about doing these stories. So you call it the markup method, and it's a bit like the scientific method, isn't it? Where you sort of build the data, test the hypothesis, you then sort of verify it. You call it making it bulletproof, the rigorous review process that you have, and also showing your work, showing your methodology, which of course you have to do in the scientific method as well. Very interested if you could share with our listeners the genesis of how you decided to do it that way, and you know, that incredibly inspirational commitment to transparency that you have.
Yeah, you know, the markup method is like our kind of version of taking a scientific approach. And it's really actually based on a book from the 1970s by this professor, Philip Meyer. He wrote a book called Precision Journalism. And he said that journalists need to be more like social scientists. They need to look at larger data sets and bring statistical analysis into their stories, because the world was getting more complex and more, and there was more data available, and it was incumbent on journalists to increase their literacy in this area and to take a more scientific approach to their work. And that, his work has been sort of a guiding light for me for a long time. And so I modeled the markup method a little bit on his book and his thoughts on how to bring the scientific method into journalism, because it's also worth noting that we're not actually science, and we're still journalists, right? We're still at a lesser level, honestly, than scientists. You know, we don't get full peer review. We don't have some sort of test of whether our results are reproducible, although we would like them to be, and we aim for that. We also don't do a lot of the things that they do in terms of, like, we would not sort of take, certain lot of scientists are funded by the companies that they study. We wouldn't do that, you know, so there's a lot of differences. But I think it's really important to go into a story with a hypothesis and then test if that hypothesis is true. And the reason I say that is, if you're really a traditional way to be a journalist is to be very opportunistic, you know, oh, I found a cool data set over here. Oh, I got a little leak or a scoop over here. And I'm not opposed to those. Those are all good techniques, but also it's worth noting those have been weaponized, right? I mean, the strategic leaks of Hillary Clinton's emails in 2016 were a way to weaponize that excitement that the press has about leaks and use it against the political process. And I think journalists are more and more in the position of being manipulated. There are, what, 8 to 10 PR people for each journalist in the United States. We're outnumbered, we're outspent, we're outgunned. And so I think if we take the time to develop our own questions, what are the most important questions that we could answer, and then go seek the data, we will find ourselves in a better position. If we look at what data is opportunistically available, that data is going to serve a political purpose. The truth is that institutions don't collect data about things that they don't want known. There's a reason that there's no database anywhere of police shootings, right? The Washington Post had to at great expense and won a Pulitzer for assembling their own database about that. And the reason is because it wasn't in anyone's political interest to build one. And that's what journalists should do. We should think about those questions where there isn't data and create those data sets in order to provide accountability.
I mean, you touched on the challenges of journalism there anyway, in terms of you're outgunned, you're outspent, and so on and so forth. As we recall this, President Trump is going to remain the president for another 31 minutes. And then by the time this comes out, we'll have President Biden, and thank goodness for that. But do you think that we've closed a chapter on this antagonism that people have toward journalism, that, you know, he was a very large part of stoking up this so-called fake news? I mean, I suppose if I could reduce it to one question, it's, let's say that you have a young member of your family that aspires to go into journalism. Would you encourage that person to do so? Or would you say they'd be better off going into public relations? Because it does seem to me that it's, you know, that public relations is better paid and, frankly, less hassle. You're not going to get all the brickbats and the attacks that person's done. I spoke to a journalist a couple of months ago on this podcast, and he said that journalism is the worst job in the entire world, unless you just happen to think that it's the best job.
I think there's a lot of, like, I remember when I started in journalism, which was legitimately 30 years ago, so I'm showing my age here, but I remember a journalist telling me then, you know, oh, this profession is dying. You should go out. You shouldn't do it. It's so hard. And it's true. It has been dying the whole time I've been in it, right? Every place I was at was doing rounds of layoffs. I always saw the industry shrinking. I never saw it in a growth mode. But that doesn't mean it's not worth doing, you know? And so I don't like the sort of idea of like, oh, let's shut it all down. You know, there's no hope. There's always hope. In fact, that's the only way that we can survive is with hope. And I think building something like the markup is my way of trying to inject hope into this. Like, here's a new way to build trust with your readers. Don't track them, provide them all the data, give them white papers that they can analyze so they can see that you really are doing the work and you didn't just make it up and it wasn't an anonymous source, right? And it wasn't a strategic leak from WikiLeaks telling you that they wanted to throw the election. It was, the work is out there. We can let you vet it. The readers. And so I think that building new trust with readers is our goal. And I think it's something that will help all of journalism. And I think journalism is necessary for democracy. And so if we want a democracy, which I think we all collectively made that decision in the past few months as we fought to get the election results approved, I think that we need journalism. And so I would encourage people to go into it. Yes, it's a really tough profession. You have to be willing to go into a tough profession, but there are a lot of professions that are tough. Being a nurse is tough, right? They've gone through it hell this past year, being a doctor. So there are a lot of professions that are hard. And I think you have to go with the one that calls you.
There are very few women running investigative newsrooms. How do you feel about that?
You know, it's interesting that this is a very male profession. Journalism is in general, and investigative journalism in particular. And I've always worked for men in investigative roles. And I have been always one of the rare women on investigative teams. And so it is a challenge building a newsroom as a woman. There are different constraints placed on women, right? Like I don't get to be a yeller because that would be called a bitch, right? There are certain ways that you have to act as a woman that are different. And there aren't a lot of role models for women, right? Like, I don't have a woman I can look to for advice, like who led a newsroom. All my mentors who have led newsrooms, and I have great ones, are men. And they're really great at guiding me, and they've given me lots of great advice, but the rules are different for them. And so I think it's, I appreciate you asking that question, because it is a challenge that I face, and is one that I think isn't talked about enough, which is that journalism at the low levels is pretty diverse, but at the high levels, it's really not. And that needs to change. And so I'm hoping that I can be a role model for other women who want to get into the profession and want to get into leadership roles.
I think you already are a role model, genuinely. I'm hugely inspired by what you've achieved so far and what you're going to go on to achieve. And if I can close then, asking you who your heroes and villains are, what fellow journalists do inspire you? And do you have any journalist villains? I mean, you know, Tucker Carlson can't be top of your favorites list, surely. You might even want to argue whether he's even a journalist or not.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't dignify him with the word journalist, but I will tell you, there are two women who really inspire me that I look to all the time, and they're both dead. Ida Tarbell and Ida B. Wells. So Ida Tarbell was a journalist at the turn of the century, and she was a muckraker. She was the one who wrote this five-part series about Standard Oil and how they were abusing their monopoly power. And it led to the breakup of Standard Oil and really the strengthening of antitrust laws in our country. And to me, she's a real hero of data journalism. She collected a lot of data. She analyzed it. She made it into a narrative. And she was a real pioneer in business journalism. There wasn't a lot of focus on business at that time. So she's somebody, I have a picture of her up on my wall in my room, and she's a hero of mine. And Ida B. Wells is also a hero of mine. She was also a data journalist. She's a Black woman, crusading journalist in the 30s about lynching in America. And she wrote and collected data about all the lynching of Black men and sometimes Black women across the country, and kept talking about it, set up her own publications in the face of violence and oppression and all sorts of people who wanted to silence her. She continued publishing and really did lead to the rules that finally made lynching illegal, and also had people enforce those rules because it was already illegal. And so I looked to both of them as women who fought against the odds, really brought data to their work in order to make it credible, and also told the narratives. You can't just lead with the data. You also have to tell the story of the humans who are impacted by your work. And so I always think of them when I think of my heroines.
Julia, that was a hugely interesting conversation. I'm incredibly inspired by what you're doing, and I wish you the very best of luck with it. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.